Welcome back to Eco Talk, and in this segment we're going to explore the issue of environmental justice, environmental injustice, as is too often the case, with someone from Grist magazine who's been working on the issue. Catherine Schultz is joining us, and in Grist we trust. They have the most fabulous environmental news website ever. Go to grist.org if you want to be informed, but also entertained. I really love the way you guys always put a little sense of humor on it, because it's not funny, it's pretty scary, but there's a lot of irony in the way we Americans deal with our environment. Or don't.
Yeah, thanks. Those are nice words to hear. You're right. These are very sobering issues, but I do think they need to be handled with some amount of levity, if only to capture the public attention and get people started talking about what are actually really, really important issues.
Yeah, and why did you decide to do this issue in a multi-part series? I imagine because there is so much to talk about.
Exactly. And not only is there so much to talk about, but there's so much that historically hasn't been talked about. And while we certainly can do, you know, single standalone articles that are really important and will make some amount of splash, we felt strongly that we would garner more attention and get people thinking in a more holistic way about these issues if we were able to really almost kind of draw a map of the range of issues that we're talking about and the kinds of people they affect, and get people to really incorporate this into their sense of what constitutes an environmental issue.
And to get us all on the same page, maybe what does it mean, environmental justice, if you can give us sort of a working definition?
Sure, that's a good place to start. I mean, essentially, environmental justice is the pretty straightforward idea that poor communities and communities of color should not have to shoulder an unfair share of environmental problems. And for that matter, you know, they should also have equal access to environmental benefits and to environmental decision-making processes. So, and the term, as you can imagine, came about in response to the existence of environmental racism and environmental classism, i.e., the tendency to disproportionately locate sources of environmental problems and sometimes environmental catastrophes in poor and disenfranchised communities.
Well, the NIMBY factor with
exactly.
You know, communities and individuals who have the clout to protest a power plant, that may not be the case in a poorer community. And they're living downstream more often than more privileged Americans, I suppose, in the big sense. So is this something you're seeing in communities across the country, or is it worse in certain regions?
This is absolutely something that's an issue across the country. Needless to say, it's not an issue in extraordinarily wealthy communities, although those communities face environmental concerns of their own. But one thing that was really interesting in working on this series, and that we were very determined to demonstrate through the series, is how omnipresent these kinds of problems are, and they take a different form if you're, you know, in the south side of Chicago, or you're in L.A., or you're on Native American reservation in Wisconsin, or you're on the U.S.-Mexico border, but they exist in all of these communities. And as different as the specific problems might be, the same kinds of systemic issues underlie them all.
And some national examples, first one that comes to mind is Katrina, because it was people who didn't have, you know, cars and other transportation alternatives who were stranded first in the flooding.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I think for a lot of people, that really put this idea of environmental injustice on the map and got folks thinking about the ways that, in fact, poor people are affected disproportionately, both by environmental disasters and, sadly, as we saw, by the organized response to those disasters. So that certainly, you know, is the most glaring recent example.
What are some others?
Let's see. Well, another one that's actually been in the public eye for longer than some of these issues is mountaintop removal mining, which is just absolutely devastating communities and livelihoods and, needless to say, the land all across West Virginia and, in fact, all of Appalachia. Another big thing that we're seeing more and more of in recent decades is concentrated animal feed operations. These are, you know, these huge agribusiness ventures of pig farms or chicken farms that take up acres and acres and acres and produce shocking amounts of waste every day and destroy entire water systems and really just wreck the surrounding communities. But sadly, I could go on and on, you know, hazardous waste storage, resource extraction, things like mining. Really, almost every environmental problem you can think of has an environmental justice component. I mean, nobody's trying to ship nuclear waste to Scarsdale, for instance.
Right, just Nevada. So one example that may not be quite so obvious is access to healthy organic produce and and the overabundance of vending machines and, you know, places that are mostly selling, you know, candy, soda, and liquor.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we sometimes hear about those issues in the context of growing concerns about things like childhood obesity and the kinds of cheap food that is available, you know, even within schools, but certainly in the neighborhoods that kids and especially poor kids are growing up in, where they're, you know, really reliant on McDonald's because there is a McDonald's on the corner and there isn't a regular supermarket even within, you know, one bus ride away. So absolutely, the way that our national food distribution system works is a huge issue for the poor. And this is an example of an area where actually, as a nation, we've made some environmental gains. The organic food movement is really doing quite well and is really a wonderful thing. But unfortunately, those environmental advantages, like environmental disadvantages, are unfairly distributed among poor versus wealthy people.
And as is so often the case, environmental issues are so connected to health issues. You mentioned obesity, but we also have a diabetes epidemic almost in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, of course, is very closely correlated to, you know, the kinds of food that we're taking in and also, you know, to the kinds of health care available to us and when we're able to access it and how early on. But across the board, these environmental issues and health issues are very deeply related. We see that in things like childhood asthma levels in poor communities. We see it certainly in lead poisoning. We see it in cancer clusters in places like Cancer Alley, the petrochemical corridor that runs through Louisiana. So these issues are really inextricable.
Now, if we can refer to a movement, the environmental movement, perhaps not addressing these issues enough, because of that, is there sort of an environmental justice movement that's separate from the traditional movement emerging, are new faces emerging to lead this effort? So why hasn't the typical, you know, let's face it, white, fairly well-to-do, comfortable enough to be able to be concerned about environmental issues, not really noticed or taken on some of these environmental justice issues, and maybe just by definition it's going to have to come from people most affected?
Yeah, I think, well, let me tackle sort of the first part of that question first and whether there's separate movements here and where the environmental justice movement comes from. It's not just in recent decades or in recent times that it's emerging. Certainly people have been talking about environmental justice both nationally and internationally since, you know, at the very least the 80s and probably well before then, but in a very organized way since the 1980s. And, you know, at the moment I do think it's safe to say that these are two separate movements, that the environmental justice movement and the mainstream environmental movement are in some ways doing their own thing. That said, I think that there are increasing efforts to try to find the common ground between these movements and work together. Obviously, the mainstream environmental movement at this point is so established and has quite a lot of clout and money and quite a lot of technical expertise. And I think there is some general sentiment that if that can be brought to bear on the kind of local knowledge and local passion and activism that the environmental justice movement represents, that could actually be a very happy marriage of these two movements.
What can our listeners do besides go to grist.org and read the series, and it's still underway?
Yes, we'd certainly love for people to do that. But in addition to that, and also, you know, as one avenue of that, I think that listeners can do what we can all do all the time, which is really do everything we can to educate ourselves. And by that I mean, you know, if you're someone who's already interested in environmental issues, I would really encourage you to think hard about what that means to you and what you mean by the environment. I mean, does that mean Yellowstone? Or does it also mean some kid's backyard or some blue-collar workplace? And how can we unite those kinds of concerns and can we fight those battles together? And, you know, conversely, if you don't think you care that much about the environment, if it's not one of your really top priority issues,
it doesn't really affect you at all. Just try going one day without food, water, or air, and say you don't care about your environment.
In that case, I would encourage people to think about the whole range of issues that you're dismissing. I mean, it is absolutely food and water. It's not just spotted owls and redwoods. And I think the one thing we all learn from studying the environment is just how interconnected all of these things are, and that includes us, right? That includes people, whether we're in Brooklyn or in Louisiana or in Bangladesh or wherever we are.
Terrific. And what kinds of other bigger issues do you tackle at GRIST for those who may not be familiar with it?
Well, you know, our mission and mandate is purposely as broad as possible. We look at national as well as international environmental issues. We see ourselves as very dedicated to exactly that task I just described of really trying to redefine what constitutes an environmental issue. So, you know, whether that's looking at something, you know, like poverty that's on the radar screen a little bit less, or, you know, whether it's looking to connect these to economic issues and what's happening in the business world. We really try to expand the boundaries of where and how these issues matter. That said, we also, of course, are dedicated to continuing to cover some of the old standbys of the environmental movement because, needless to say, clean air, clean water, wilderness, these are really important and need to have continued attention as well.
And I must say, I really enjoyed GRIST's Death of Environmentalism series over a year ago that went on and on, but I found it all very relevant to the way we Americans view and talk about our environment. I think we're out of time, Catherine, but thanks for joining us and congratulations on the series.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
We've been speaking with Catherine Schultz of GRIST Magazine about a series still in progress on GRIST.org about environmental justice, where is the movement, and what is environmental justice anyway? Stay with us. When we come back, we'll find out about what is Gail Norton's legacy? Secretary of the Interior stepping down. What does she leave behind? And even more important, what's going on with the person who's just stepping into her job? Stay with us.